Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Jeff Beckwith, the Executive Director of the Massachusetts Municipal Association, and we're very pleased to have you join us for another in the long series of briefings by the Baker-Polito administration to all of the municipal chief executive officers here in Massachusetts. The format for today's briefing will start with some updates from members of the administration, and then the Lieutenant Governor, who's with the governor right now, providing the daily press briefing on COVID-19, will then join us likely a little bit after 1:30. And when the Lieutenant Governor comes, she'll provide an update. We have an agenda that will have start with an update on the budget from Sean Cronin, of the Division of Local Services, well known to all municipal officials, I think. And then we'll have an update on the governor's eviction diversion initiative, and Undersecretary Maddox from DHCD will be providing that with her team. Then we'll hear a little bit from the Department of Public Health. We'll do our best to take questions along the way, and then Lieutenant Governor will join us. Just a couple of logistical announcements at the beginning. Because we use the chat function, I would like to encourage everyone, when you type in your question in the chat function for our panelists to answer, if you could make sure it's set so that it says to all panelists and everyone, so that the folks who are not panelists can see your question. What happens sometimes is that the questions go out to everyone and everyone can see them. Sometimes they just come to those of us whose screens you can see, and the folks are trying to follow along and it's a little disruptive. So we're gonna just ask you to make sure that you post the questions so everyone can see them. And then finally, the next briefing ordinarily would be 2 weeks from today. 2 weeks from today is Election Day. And so the next briefing is going to be scheduled on Thursday, November 5th at 10 a.m. So a different time and a different day, but we figured local government officials are going to be very busy on Election Day. So we didn't want to have this briefing take place at that time. So again, welcome. We appreciate very much the partnership that the Baker-Polito administration has forged with cities and towns and local government leaders all across the state during this extraordinarily challenging period that has been much more even than dealing with the health effects of COVID-19, but also dealing with the financial impact and the impact on families and individuals in the state. So we're going to start with an update from Sean Cronin on the updated budget submission by the governor and latest news in terms of implications for cities and towns. Sean, thanks so much for your work and for being with us.
My pleasure. So I'll give a very broad overview of the revised House 2 that came out last week, and then speak a little bit about tax rate setting in my shop. So as you know, the governor submitted revised House 2, and it provides local aid funding at least at fiscal 20 levels. Chapter 70 is up for some school districts, but other than that, UGGER and other accounts are level funded, and that's consistent with the agreement that was announced between the governor and the legislative leadership back in July. One thing I'll note that I know John Robertson passed a question along. There were some questions about the charter school figures. The answer to why some of those have gone up and some of them might have gone down is because the original House 2 back in December was based on preliminary enrollment figures. As you know, those change over time. Revised House 2 uses the updated numbers. So if your assessment went down, your reimbursement would go down and vice versa. So I know some communities are wondering why those numbers had changed, but it's based upon updated enrollment figures. Lastly, in terms of cherry sheets and setting tax rates. So last Tuesday afternoon, we sent out an alert that provided links to complete cherry sheets, which was obviously the first time we were able to do that. So every municipality, every regional school district now has all the aid components by type, all the assessments by type. So we feel we feel strongly that you should be able to move forward and set a tax rate almost as you normally would. And I say that somewhat for selfish purposes, because we still have 351 cities and towns. We still need to set 351 tax rates. Normally we do 50% of them in December anyway, and we can handle that. But if it got to, you know, 75 or 80% of all tax rates in December, that would be problematic. There'd be some downstream impacts to that as well. We might have to push off certifying free cash, which might be problematic in some instances. So we hope now that you have all components of the cherry sheet that you can move forward. If you have to have a town meeting to make adjustments or council meetings to make adjustments, we hope that you'll move forward with those and then set your tax rates. Our turnaround time should be pretty much the same, again, unless we get an extraordinarily high amount in December. So really a commercial to suggest that you move forward and get your tax rates set the rest of this month and into November, if that's where you normally did, if that's normally the time of year you did it anyway. If you're normally a December community, work toward getting that finalized for December, and we'll be able to turn around the tax rates. And one last thing on that, and then certainly take any questions if there are any. Some folks have asked, some communities have asked, do they have to use the cherry sheets based upon revised House 2? And the answer that we're saying to communities is you don't have to use it, but it can't be higher. Because I've had some communities say, hey, I already set a budget back in the spring town meeting. Really don't want to have to go back to town meeting. Can we use reduced, lower figures, i.e. the ones that we used when we originally set the budget? We're going to say yes to that up until a final state budget is approved. As you know, once the state budget is approved and the cherry sheet comes out, you have to use those numbers. So use them. That would be the maximum. But if you had set a budget earlier that assumed some sort of reduction in local aid and you don't want to go back and revisit that, then we'll move forward with your tax rate in that manner, again, until the final state budget is approved. At that point, we have no choice. So that's it on my end. Again, I don't know if there's any questions folks have.
Well, I am checking, and I don't see any questions in the chat box at this time. Again, if you make sure that all panelists and attendees, you send your questions that way. But I don't see any questions at this time. So we can move on to the next part. And then if any finance questions come in, we'll loop you right back in a little bit later. Okay, Sean?
Sounds good.
Thank you very much. Oh, and just a note, when you talked about the updated enrollment numbers for charter schools, that's something that would have ordinarily happened, usually happens during the budget process as the various, like the House budget might use some updated numbers, and then the Senate budget would, and then the conference committee would be looking at that. So this is essentially analogous to if it had been a normal budget year way back in the spring, right? Is that right?
Correct. Exactly. Yep.
Okay, excellent. Now it's my pleasure to have Undersecretary Jennifer Maddox of DHCD here to talk with all of you about the eviction diversion initiative that was announced last week. And then, of course, with the 17th, I believe it was the 17th or the 19th was the first business day with the ban or the stay of moving forward on evictions having elapsed and replaced by essentially the CDC. Now turn it over to Secretary Maddox for an update.
Hi, thank you so much. So from the outset of the pandemic, the administration has focused on keeping residents in stable housing situations. We've deployed various resources and strategies, including a significant amount of guidance as part of that commitment since March. Now remember, we had a housing crisis before the pandemic, and the pandemic has exacerbated this issue. When the governor signed the eviction and foreclosure moratorium back in April, it became another key safeguard in the interest of public health. In July, the governor exercised his authority to extend the law's limitations on evictions and foreclosures through October 17th. At the time, we determined it to be the right decision to extend out those protections as businesses cautiously reopened, people began to return to work, and we continued to take careful strides toward a new normal. It also allowed some time to develop a plan in close coordination with the trial court and a cross-agency team to ensure that when evictions proceedings resume, there are programs in place to help tenants pay their rent and stay in their homes. Now, last week, on Monday, October 12th, in partnership with the trial court, the legislature and various other stakeholders, and in advance of the pause on evictions ending on the 17th, we announced $171 million eviction diversion initiative to support tenants and landlords during the financial challenges caused by the pandemic. This comprehensive set of resources was developed by a cross-agency team assembled by the administration in coordination with the Massachusetts Trial Court and reflects input from a broad range of stakeholders. Now, some of the key highlights are approximately $100 million in emergency rental assistance through RAFT, up to $12.3 million to provide tenants and landlords with access to legal representation and related services prior to and during the eviction process, as well as community mediation to bring tenants and landlords together to find a resolution. Nearly $50 million for rapid rehousing via core programs like Homebase. Our goal is to provide new pathways for tenants to stay in their homes, ideally before the case enters the courts, and to support the expenses of landlords through the expansion of existing programs and creation of new ones. Our nine regional HCECs, Housing Consumer Education Centers, represent the front door for residents to access many state and federal programs, and new funding will enable agencies to hire special housing counselors to help households with more complicated needs navigate the available resources. The administration is also working with partners to make mediation services available for renters and landlords to support pre-court and pre-trial settlement of eviction cases where agreement cannot be reached through RAFT or IRMA, and to also provide legal representation and related services to income-eligible tenants and landlords. And as an additional safety net, should all else fail and eviction proceeds, Homebase, the Commonwealth's Rapid Rehousing Benefit, and the Strategic Prevention Initiative, SPI, will be expanded and continue to offer financial assistance and stabilization case management services to families that are there in the process of securing new stable housing as they navigate a difficult process. Now, it is important to note that we did get the word out. Any constituents who is having trouble paying rent or mortgage should call 211 or visit mass.gov/COVID-housing-help. to get their questions answered, to receive information on available resources, and to be connected with a regional agency. Thank you.
Great, thank you very much. And the MMA has posted and provided links to all the information that you've provided on our website as well. I'm just asking our members who are here if there are any questions. Any questions to post in the chat? I don't see any at this stage. It's a quiet day so far, and you're providing a lot of information out there. So if you could stand by in case any questions come in a little bit later on. I'm hoping that the chat function is working because usually we have lots of questions. Here's a question from Mayor Yvonne Spicer. What's the turnaround for funding?
In terms of the RAFT program?
I believe so.
Yeah, so what we're doing is we streamlined our RAFT application during the process of developing our eviction diversion initiatives. We learned that it takes too long to process the RAFT application. And so we have streamlined our RAFT application, and that will cut down on the processing time. We're working very closely with the regional administering agencies for RAFT so that they can staff up and be ready to help folks, and not only just the tenants, but also the landlords, because they'll also have an opportunity to apply on behalf of the tenant as long as they have the approval from the tenant.
And then there's a question here, which is, how do you decide who's eligible, who receives RAF funding?
And so, Amy, do you want to take that one?
Sure. So any tenant who meets the income eligibility for RAFT, which is 50% of area median income, which does vary by community, 60% of area median income if a household is facing domestic violence, is eligible for RAFT. So that is the base eligibility. If you live in subsidized housing, meaning your rent is calculated as a share of your income, like public housing or Section 8 voucher or an MRBP voucher. And before you can get RAFT, you have to request the rent adjustment for your income first and retroactively. And then only after making that step can you access the program. There's also another program, though, for those who make a little bit more money and the 50 to 80% area median income, and that is called IRMA. So people don't need to know their income eligibility, whether they're RAFT or IRMA. They should just go to the regional agency that is assigned to their community. And if you go to the website and say, find my regional agency, whether you click on, I think the button is help for landlords and renters. Find my regional agency, you scroll down, you'll see all the income eligibility information and who to contact.
Thank you very much. There are a couple of other questions that have come in. One has to do with actually being able to monitor the number of eviction motions that are initiated and are underway. And so one local official is asking, is it possible to get data on the number of evictions filed in our communities? That question is from Mayor Kim Driscoll. And obviously there's a lot of concern out there that while it may not have started with a peak, it could be growing, and there could be a lot of people who are really in a precarious situation. And is it possible for local officials to find out if this is a growing problem in their communities?
Roberta, would you like to handle that question, please?
Sure, Jennifer. So I will be speaking with the courts. We have regular conversations going on with the chief justices of the trial court, housing court, and district court, as well as their staff, and I can raise that with them as far as our ability to get current information.
You know, one thing I can say is that we are developing a dashboard. We're working very closely with the trial court, understanding exactly what they captured today. And seeing if there's an opportunity to expand that as well, because we do understand that data is very important. And so we are going to continue to work with them very closely, because we do want to track the funding that we have available and the programs and who are we serving and how we can help folks and see where potential evictions might be happening. So it's a great question.
And then there's another question, and it's asked by a mayor. So the question is, how can a mayor be helpful? But I think that how can any municipal CEO be helpful in turn? And I think that there's probably a very big public education need out there to try and put people who are either renters or landlords in touch with these resources. So what do you have as recommendations for how local officials who don't have a direct role in the process can really help accelerate access to these resources?
Oh, wow, that's a great question. And so one thing that we knew early on is that we needed to have a major public awareness campaign. We needed to get the word out in terms of what existing programs are available and the new ones that we're standing up. And so, you know, we've got, we want people to know that they can call 211. And so what we've done is we've done many, in the past week, a lot of briefings for our network. And we provided FAQs, information packets, flyers. We're sending this information out to 65 plus network organizations, and our social media ads have gone live. And so what we can do is we can follow up with folks on this call afterwards and provide you with the information. Just for example, you know, people need to understand, what does a notice to quit mean? And make sure that they understand that it doesn't mean that they need to move out of their home that day. So we want to make sure that we can educate folks. And so what we can do is we can make sure that the information packets and the FAQs that we provided, that we provide you with that and a link to our website as well. Great question. because we do need everyone's help in getting the word out.
Excellent. Thank you. And thank you. I see Amy's also posted some information in the chat regarding the turnaround time for processing and applications. And also, and the one question is information available in multiple languages? I believe it is, correct? We will make sure that that any information that you provide to us is posted on our website and is with links to the whole, all that information, in addition to your pushing that out as well. So make sure that local officials have multiple channels to be able to access this the public information campaign information.
Yeah, and that's a great point. You know, the social media is up, it's live. We've been tweeting. The flyer has been updated with six different languages. So we know it's important to make sure that we are making sure that we have a translation of our documents.
Excellent, thank you. Here's a question. Local boards of health are going to get crushed with housing inspection requests. Is there any administration awareness of the need for emergency funding to bring on additional housing inspectors in many of our communities? Up to 40 to 50% of evictions trigger a Board of Health response, and our boards are way under-resourced.
You know what? I'm going to have to take that one back to the office and talk to folks internally, and we'll have to get back to you.
Okay, excellent. That's an important point and one of the benefits of having this briefing, so that you can have questions that maybe aren't frequently asked but are very important in terms of resources, right?
Yeah. Jeff, yes. If I can just add one thing to that, folks should know that those would be eligible expenditures for the Coronavirus Relief Fund monies under the CARES Act. So regardless of the state doing something, those are eligible expenses if a community wanted to bring on additional employees. And also remember, one of the bills that the governor signed back late spring, early summer, did away with the 960-hour maximum hours for retirees. So if you need to bring back retired employees to help out, that's another possibility. So all eligible.
Great. Thank you. That's an excellent point. And we're hoping that those funds can actually, CARES Act funds can be used for expenses beyond December 30th, which is the current limitation as well. So it could be the CARES Act and state monies might be needed as well. I don't see any other questions. I do encourage all of the, at this stage, we're going to move to, I'm going to ask the DPH folks to share some information with us. But obviously you can continue. Oh, there's one more. Is there currently an expiration date on the 960-hour waiver? Sean?
I'm pretty sure it's the end of this calendar year. I'll double check that, but I'm pretty sure that's what it is.
Okay, excellent, thank you. Yeah, it looks like we might start to need another municipal relief five or something to deal with the things that are expiring because of the duration of this public health emergency. That's an excellent question from Vanessa Hale. And then also Roberta Rubin from DHCD has also posted some more information in the chat. Encourage our viewers to take a look at the chat for these responses as well. At this point, we're going to pivot a little bit. We want to obviously have time for the Lieutenant Governor when she joins us in a little bit. I'm going to ask two officials from the Department of Public Health to provide an update. The first would be Dr. Larry Madoff, just commenting on what the recent trends are showing. Obviously, the number of positive tests have been going up in recent weeks. And then after that, we'll have Assistant Secretary Jana Ferguson talk about the travel order. But Dr. Madoff, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff, and thanks to all of you for joining us, and thanks for your partnership with DPH over the 9 months now that we've been continuing to work with you all on the state's COVID-19 response. We are continuing to monitor and evaluate COVID-19 public health data. And I think you know, while we are seeing some worrisome things right now, it's important to remember the overall progress that we've made since the spring. In a press conference last week, Governor Baker outlined the tremendous work that we, that all of you have done in the state since March, and how we are preparing for the fall and the winter to come. We are in better shape in many ways from what we've learned, what we've done with regard to hospital surge preparedness, with a huge ramping up in testing and contact tracing capabilities, our abilities to manage patients, our medical care for patients, keeping patients out of the hospital and better caring for patients, the tools we have available now for taking care of people in the hospital, improvements in PPE supplies, and much more. The Commonwealth continues to be informed by data, and we keep a close eye on all of the metrics. I don't need to tell you that the country as a whole is having a surge right now, with over 60,000 cases reported in the U.S. Yesterday, and we in Massachusetts are not an island. We here in the state, we had our first day reporting over 800 positive tests in months. And so, of course, we're concerned. And this and other indicators have shown some upward trends. Our positive test rate, which was down below 1%, is now above 1% and has been for a couple of weeks now. Our hospitalization numbers have trended up a bit. And our other parameters, we monitor so many different metrics daily, but I think it's safe to say that many of them are showing some upward trends, and it's something that we're paying close attention to. Of course, many more of the cities and towns are now in the red and yellow indicators on our weekly map. I can point, and that where are these cases coming from? The answer is there's no simple or one place where we're seeing this. And in some respects, some aspects of the state are doing really well. For example, I was on a call with higher education, and higher education in our state has done extremely well. They have, in terms of numbers of cases and the amount of testing that's going on in our higher education institutions, we have not seen the issues that have been seen elsewhere around the country. And we're really pleased with that. Similarly, in our K-12 schools, although, not a huge number are open for, fully, we have had very few cases and clusters in K-12 schools, and that's another bright spot. And there's no single part of the state or part of or communities or institutions or settings that we're seeing the predominance of cases from. So, some are related to clusters, some are related to hospital outbreaks, many are related to household transmission, which we now recognize as a big factor, but there's no single factor, and it's something that we are continuing to closely monitor, and that we work with the command center, with the secretary, with the governor, every day in monitoring this and responding to. I did mention one of the bright spots has been testing. Our Stop the Spread sites will continue now through the end of the year. They were originally scheduled to end the end of this month, and we will now continue them through the end of the year. A new testing site is going to go up in Revere. I believe that's being announced today. It's in a mega testing site where there will be a lot of free and easily available testing. It gets us to the point where Massachusetts is really leading the country in available testing, and yet our rates still remain way below most of the country. So the answer is we are concerned, we are keeping an eye on this daily, and we'll continue to work with you all in keeping us all safe. It's as we come into a cold weather season, a lot of things are going to become more difficult, and we recognize that. And we really depend on our stakeholders like you to work with us and keep us where we want to be. Jana, I can turn it over to you if you want to add anything.
Thank you so much, Larry. I appreciate that. And, you know, just to add on to what Larry was saying, I have regular interactions with the local health departments. Some of you may be on the calls that I have with local health departments twice weekly on Tuesday afternoons and Friday mornings. So those are also opportunities to work closely with you as municipalities to help make sure that you can address the spread of this disease in your communities, and to have opportunities to talk, to share, you know, new guidance or information that's coming out, and also to hear from you what your concerns are. So these are other opportunities for you to interact with us and help us think through and problem solve with you on ways to address this in your communities. Jeff, I know a question had come up around the travel order. I don't know if you want me to just go ahead and speak to that, or if there's something specific.
No, okay. Please do. An update on the travel order would be helpful.
Okay, great. So a question had come in to the organizers of these calls related to the change to the travel order that was recently made as of last Friday. So there were, I think people are familiar with the requirements where travelers from Massachusetts or to Massachusetts have to, if they are coming from a lower or a higher risk state or area, are required to fill out a travel form and then to quarantine for 14 days or to provide evidence or to get a test either prior 72 hours prior to travel or after they return to Massachusetts or come to Massachusetts, so they can basically essentially test out of quarantine requirements. There were some modifications made on Friday related to the metrics that are reviewed and calculated as part of the consideration of a lower risk state. Dr. Madoff made a reference to all metrics that the state is reviewing and just generally to understand the trend of disease in Massachusetts, but they're also reviewing those same metrics in context with other states. So we can calculate among other things, whether or not there is an area that has a lower rate of disease where we might be able to consider them to be a lower risk state for traveling. So the metrics that were changed as of last Friday are really looking at a couple of things. One is a change to the number of cases. So we had previously used a threshold of six daily cases per 100,000 to determine whether or not a state was considered a lower risk state. That has changed to 10 per 100,000. So that's now the standard that Massachusetts will use, and it brings us more in line with other states. So this is kind of comparable, in particular with how, like, say, for Connecticut and New York are doing they're using that same number. In addition, we're looking at a positive test rate below 5%. And both of those are measured on a rolling average. There is some differentiation, and this is on the website, and so I don't want to get too into the weeds on this. So you can look it up. In some cases, we'll be looking at 2 weeks of data in order to, for example, move a state from lower risk to high risk. We'll be looking at 1 week of data in another context. But there's 2 points, I think, for the purposes of here. The data is really posted on COVIDExitStrategy.org, and there's a link to that on the travel order website too. So people can look at that and kind of get a sense of where things are. In addition, the lower risk states are also posted on that website. And then information is posted on Friday. So if there's a change to states, that information is posted on Friday. So there's a way to kind of keep, you know, to check in as well as the announcements that might be made over social media. So last Friday, a few more states were added. So there are now more lower risk states where people can travel and don't have to, or travel from and don't have to quarantine. Rhode Island is still not considered one of those lower risk states. I know there's a lot of questions, particularly with the border communities around the Rhode Island border, about whether or not that applies. But Rhode Island is still not considered a lower risk state. But you can go to Hawaii again. So there's that.
If you want to be 10 or 8 hours.
Right. There's that problem.
We have a couple of questions that came in. I know the Lieutenant Governor is trying right now to connect, so I want to squeeze these in. From Western Mass, a question about the length of time it takes to turn around on the test. That hearing that it's 3 to 5 days, but their experience is it tends to be more like 4 to 6 days. So is there any update in terms of being able to have as fast a turnaround time as possible in terms of testing? And then the second question is, are there any metrics that correlate with the number of cases in pre-K to 12 settings with the amount of students accessing in-person education? In other words, is there any data that can be shared?
Sure. Well, I'll take the first question, which is about turnaround time in testing. We actually do very well on the whole in Massachusetts, in part because so much of the testing is actually done here in Massachusetts. Many of our acute care hospitals do their own testing in-house, and we have the Broad Institute, which is based in Cambridge and does a huge amount of testing, including for some of the Stop the Spread sites, and their turnaround time is generally on the order of 24 hours. And so our average turnaround time, which is something that we do track in Massachusetts, is under 2 days on average. And really, that's very good nationally. And that's for the PCR tests that do need to be done in a laboratory or sent back and forth. And at the Stop the Spread sites, the turnaround time also is under 2 days as a rule. So there are some of the facilities that are using the national laboratories are experiencing longer turnaround times, but even those should be less than 3 to 5 days. So I would invite Ms. LaChapelle to contact me, and maybe we can try to figure out where those issues are arising. We should, in general, have good turnaround times. Jana, did you want to add something?
When you're done with that part of the question, I can speak to the school post, the school information.
Okay. Yeah, that's really all I have to say about the turnaround time. We do very well, and I would say that on average we are well below 2 days in our turnaround time on average. So
the particular concern, it just was posted in the chat from Mayor LaChapelle, regarding data for testing at Bay State Holyoke Medical.
Okay, I can look into that. I think that they do some of their own testing at Bay State, and so I would be surprised if it was that long, but I will be happy to look into that more.
Great, thank you very much, Dr. Madoff. And Assistant Commissioner Ferguson, there's the K-12 question, and also a question in the chat regarding travel orders, including an exemption for help for family members to go to medical appointments and so on. You can see the full question in the chat.
Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. So I will open up the chat so I can see that. So the changes to the travel orders that were made last week don't include any modifications to those kind of critical life functions that had been allowed prior. So it's still acceptable, for example, to go across state lines to seek medical attention. And there is a provision in there that allows for like giving assistance to a family member who might otherwise need to get to take your child to a pediatrician or your elderly parent. So provided that you're not staying overnight as part of that care, you can take your family member to that appointment and then to return back. So that's still allowed. And there's a fairly good explanation of the types of activities that are allowed under the quarantine orders or the travel orders without having to quarantine. So I do encourage people to look at that site. There have been no changes to that. Related to the school postings, every Wednesday, the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education posts information online about the number of cases per school district, as, in addition to the state totals. So they break it down, the number of students in hybrid in-person learning models, and then they also look at staff. So it's the students and the staff. So I think it's the staff also is a slightly different view where it is really staff who might have had access to the building. So I would encourage people also to go to the DOE website. I believe that it is, it's DOE. I just Googled it. So if you did like a school COVID DESE, it goes right to the spreadsheets. These are posted every week. Right now there's 3 weeks of data that's made available. So I would encourage people to take a look at those. And they aren't, they're just the numbers of cases. It isn't a lot of other, there's no concern about the medically identifiable information, but this is a service that Department of Elementary and Secondary Education is making available to municipalities. And then you can kind of see that by district.
And Jenna, thank you, because an enterprising local official just Googled and posted in the chat what you were talking about. So we can take the hints. We'll also make sure to post that link on the MMA website as well. So that's great to know that information is provided weekly. And now I see that the Lieutenant Governor is here, and it's always great to see you, Lieutenant Governor. Thank you so much. You're having a whirlwind day coming right from the briefing into this one. But without further ado, Lieutenant Governor Karen Pulido, this briefing is yours. And thank you, as always, for your partnership and all of your leadership efforts.
Well, thank you, Jeff. It sounds like you're all doing just fine without me. And it appears that you've covered a lot of important topics from the budget with Sean Cronin's input. Obviously, any COVID-related questions, Jenna and Larry always available, and the Eviction Diversion Initiative. I'm sure you had a good exchange of information there, and we'll continue to monitor that and work with you as needed. As many of you know, there was no book written to how to deal with matters in a pandemic, and we are all trying our best when an issue arises to put together a plan to address it and then adjust as you go along, which is something we've all had to do throughout this process. I wanted to just share some good news. It's STEM week in the Commonwealth. It's the third one that we have run as an administration. And I just share that with you to share with your school officials, because we're looking to provide our students with as many robust learning opportunities as possible, whether they're in a remote setting, a hybrid setting, or in-person setting. And as we all know in this pandemic, STEM skills and abilities are clearly a part of it, a big part of it. Whether our frontline dealing with the response from a healthcare perspective, or the manufacturers pivoting to making PPE throughout this pandemic, or the amazing work that's being done to research and develop a vaccine and better treatments. All of it involves STEM abilities. And clearly here in Massachusetts, we have an abundance of them, but we need more. So a lot of good STEM opportunities this week. Check them out. The fall and winter readiness is what we spent our time with our friends in Revere focusing on today. They set up a new Stop the Spread, or the newest Stop the Spread site in our Commonwealth. It's free, as everyone knows. It's quick. And at that site, you make an appointment in advance, but they have so much capacity, literally no one will be turned away. And in our lab capacity, we can now handle processing 100,000 tests per day in a turnaround time. It's pretty quick. So we've come a long way since the beginning of our testing program, and we want it to be a key tool for communities and regions within our communities to be able to use. We also know that we need to be prepared not only for the winter weather that undoubtedly will come our way. In fact, when we were in Revere, we were standing on a site that was the place where much snow from the region was delivered and stockpiled during the 2015 winter. Not that any of us are wishing for a winter like that. Let's hope for a mild one. But clearly, stockpiling and being ready with the PPE is also important. We have millions of pieces of equipment in our stockpile, ventilators, masks, gowns, all of the things that we were so struggling to get our hands on early on in the pandemic are at our ready. The hospitals are also part of our planning effort, of course. They have capacity at approximately 50% ICU capacity available, and additional beds can be made available pretty quickly, setting up field site capacity if we needed that in a surge scenario. I think it's really good news to be talking about a vaccine advisory group and the fact that our administration submitted to the federal government a plan around the distribution of a COVID-19 vaccine. It's been a long time dealing with this, and to be at this point in time where we're planning for that effort and see that on the horizon is really good news for all of us. I think when you think about yourself in a tunnel and you see some light at the end of the tunnel, I feel like that's some light for all of us. The advisory group is there to advise us, obviously, around the safe and effective distribution of vaccines. We have a robust distribution capacity. I don't know if others talked about this, that this work builds on and enhances the state's experience in distributing approximately 3 million vaccine doses each year. That's what we already know we can do. So we'll utilize that system to distribute future vaccine. So we're really pleased about that. And we have an immunization and information system that is also state of the art, with more than 3,000 provider sites currently reporting data into the system around immunizations. So that is also there to help us distribute and track the COVID-19 in the future as it's distributed. Budget, I think Sean probably covered a lot of great detail there. With your support, we were able to design a budget based upon revised revenue forecast that continues our commitment to municipal funding, which is something that you need for building your own budgets around. So I'm pleased that that has been shared with you relative to UGA and Chapter 70 aid. And like many of you, your savings account is really important for that rainy day. And as you build up free cash, we've been able to build up our stabilization fund over the course of these past few years. And as we know, it's raining, and we needed to tap into $1.35 billion of it for the fiscal 21 budget, but it leaves us with 2.2 and some change in the fund as we plan for the future budget. So that's really important. And you know what's in the budget. I just wanted to just acknowledge everyone's efforts there, working together with the legislature. We will finalize that in the time period that's needed to assess all the components of it. And I will just close with that and then see if there are any additional questions that you might have or areas that you would like us to research further, get back to you on, or address at our upcoming meeting. I would say I've been spending some time with municipal officials talking about economics, you know, jobs and small businesses and your main street and your downtowns and what that part of your community looks like. obviously responding to the COVID is one piece of this, but economic reopening and recovery is another piece of this. And soon we'll be able to give you some specific information around economic recovery and how you can partner with us in helping your small businesses and micro businesses and downtown and Main Street establishments in the upcoming months. I also know that on the housing front, we did a lot of good work together, and we'll continue to monitor landlords and tenants' needs within your communities as well.
Lieutenant Governor, earlier there was a good sort of chat discussion back and forth, and there's some more information and research that's going to be done by DHCD regarding being able to provide some information about the magnitude of the issue of the evictions issue in communities, but also a great array of resources to help go out and educate citizens, and local officials are going to be using that, the toolkits and the information that's provided, and other resources. And this is an area where local government officials really look forward to partnering with you on mm-hmm. this initiative. In addition, I do note in the chat, it's not a surprise that Mayor Spicer said STEM plus innovation equals new career pathways, since before becoming mayor, she was a senior executive at the Museum of Science. I think that STEM would be an issue of great interest for her and for everyone. And it's good to see all this focus on other areas where Massachusetts can lead, in addition to dealing with the novel coronavirus. One, in terms of the economic recovery, in addition to incorporating that into future briefings, the MMA would just right now on the spot offer to work on a special webinar presentation by your team for our local officials that we can sort of have as a one-stop shop for presentation for all of this. And then we'll put that together with you in partnership and get that out to all of our members as well.
We would look forward to that. I think that's what the greatness of this partnership is, the sharing of information so that we can design the programs that are easy to access and turn the dollars around to make the difference. Take the Shared Streets and Spaces program. Many of you said to us, just make it really easy, make it a simple form. Small dollars, you know, turn into action pretty quickly. I mean, I'm so proud of what all of you were able to do in taking those dollars and turning your sidewalks and parking lots and public places into dining venues that really, really made a difference over the course of the summer into the early fall, and helping a lot of the restaurants and small businesses have activity. That's just one great example. And, you know, some of the things that we'll learn when we look back at this pandemic time period are the things that were proven that should continue beyond this response period that will become more permanent in nature. So we'll all take some lessons at a future MMA conference or webinar or an in-person event when we learn the lessons from this time and do more of them going forward. Well, I look forward to MMA too in January, where you'll be covering a lot of this, perhaps virtually, but I look forward to some of the things that we can be talking and planning for that event as well.
Absolutely. Well, we have a special slot reserved for you at our annual conference, even though it is going to be virtual. We're going to try and make it not look like a normal Zoom meeting. So we'll see how that goes. I do think that as you mentioned, light at the end of the tunnel, maybe as you're working on vaccine planning, as you're working on the further ways that we transition out, for local government officials who have had to turn on a dime and reinvent the way they deliver services, for you and the administration trying to figure out how to smooth the pathways to make government as swift and responsive as possible, there are a lot of lessons learned here, a lot of ways to innovate that certainly can be carried forward in a post pandemic environment for government, and in many ways where there will potentially be significant improvements. So that's all very good. We do have a maybe one more question coming in because we have 2 minutes. We also posted that our virtual annual meeting is January 21st and 22nd. The marketing information is going out very soon, and we look forward to a great event, Lieutenant Governor, with you, with the governor, and with some other outstanding speakers and leaders. I don't see any other questions typed in the chat. So with that, any final words, Lieutenant Governor?
Just that thank you to the team, yours and ours, for coming together faithfully to this hour. We learn a lot. You pick up some new materials, and you get out there and do your work to respond to the needs in your community. I just want to say again, can't say it enough, how grateful the governor and I are for a strong and talented local government workforce from one end of the state to the other. Really grateful for your leadership and for your help to make us more responsive to your needs, which means that we're all better serving the people of our Commonwealth. So thank you all very much, and look forward to our next time together.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor, and thank you to your team who participated today, and to all the dozens and hundreds and thousands of others who are working to connect with and help local government, and of course to all of our local government leaders who inspire us from everything that they've done. I want to make a note about the next briefing, which ordinarily would be 2 weeks from today. But 2 weeks from today is Election Day, and we have a sneaking suspicion that local officials will be very busy. So this next briefing, for one time only, will be on a Thursday, November 5th at 10 a.m. And that's the next briefing. And then we'll resume with the every other Tuesdays, which do seem to come very rapidly since there's so much happening. So until that time, we will post the recording of this webinar on the MMA website so all local officials can access it, and then provide a summary and all of the information. But to Lieutenant Governor, to you and your team, thank you very much. And to all local officials, be safe, and thank you for your continued leadership. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Thanks, everybody.